We are looking at Nehemiah, so let's turn there. Nehemiah is the second to last history book in the Old Testament. If you've gone to Esther, you've gone too far. If you are around, what is it, Ezra, you have not gone far enough. Nehemiah is stuck right in the middle. What I thought I would do is just read Nehemiah chapter 1 this morning. I'm kind of in the same predicament. I complained last week that there's so much good stuff, and I can't read the whole book, and I'm sort of there again, but I feel like chapter 1 will just give us a good starting point, and then we'll begin from there. Nehemiah chapter 1, it says, "The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Susa, the citadel, that Hananiah, one of my brothers, came with certain men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who escaped, who had survived the exile, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, 'The remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates are destroyed by fire.' As soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And I said, 'O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for the people of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Even I and my father's house have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, the rules that you commanded your servant Moses. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of heaven, from there I will gather them and bring them to the place that I have chosen to make my name dwell there. They are your servants and your people, whom you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name and give success to your servant today, and grant him mercy in the sight of man, sight of this man. Now I was cupbearer to the king." One summer morning in Andover, Ohio, there was a man named Ray Blankenship, and he was simply preparing his breakfast like he did every morning, but this morning was different. It was in the middle of a torrential downpour, and it's been raining for days, in the middle of a storm. And as he was preparing his breakfast, he looks out his window, and there was a drainage ditch that flew by his house, so went right by his house there where he lived, and he happened to see a young girl caught in the current that was being pulled down the drainage ditch. As fast as Ray could move, he busted out of that house and chased after that girl. When he was able to, when he found her and found a spot, he jumped in after her and did everything he could to grab a hold of her without going under himself. And he did everything in his power to rescue both of them now to safety, to get them both over to the side. The current was too strong. They had feet before they were going to hit the culvert and go under. And it just so happens that something was there that he felt kind of brush past his leg, past his torso, and he grabbed onto it with everything he had. And for a second, he was safe. He had the girl in his other arm. And the way this story goes is that he thought that maybe if he could just hang on to the rock, hang on to the girl until the fire department came, they would be saved. Well, he ended up doing one better than that. In the time that he had until the fire engine and the men came off it and went to the rescue, he actually was able to rescue the girl and pull her over to the side and actually get her on land. And he was halfway on land by the time they were able to pull him out of the water. It was in April 12, 1989 when this happened, this morning. And they treated both Ray and the young girl for shock, but both were saved. He actually was awarded the Coast Guard's Silver Life-Saving Medal that same month. The award is fitting, and it was fitting, for this selfless person was an even greater risk to himself than most people knew, because Ray never learned how to swim. You and I are called in this life to be courageous. But the fear of not being able to swim, most of the time, keeps us on the shore. Nehemiah's story can be an encouragement to us, I think, to live with encouragement. We are going to see, and we got a little bit from chapter 1, that this is a man, a Jew, who is living as a servant to a foreign heathen king in a foreign land, in a land actually that conquered Israel, and as we learned last week, before the exile happened, burned it to the ground, took everybody as slaves, the ones that they didn't kill, left some there, but then brought people in from all other parts of the world at that time to fill Israel so they would intermarry, so there would be no pure Jewish race anymore living there, so that they would bring in other gods and just totally wipe out Israel. And so you have this man, Nehemiah, in a sense, living all by himself in this situation, in an enemy territory, having to learn the language and the customs and all of these kinds of things. And yet we find that Nehemiah acted courageously because he knew the building blocks to courage. So I ask you this morning a very simple question. Do you want to live a life that is courageous? I think you and I would both answer that question. Yes, I think, at least ideally. I think we can look here at just a few things with Nehemiah that we can learn and take from him and put these building blocks together, and we will understand what it takes to be courageous in a world that, frankly, is really hard. It's a really tough place to be courageous. So let's jump in. The first thing, the very first thing that Nehemiah is going to learn is that it is all God's providence. It is all God's placement and all God's plan. And we see this right in chapter 1. So first, providentially, the first thing that I just want to point out is that in the very beginning, this book gets right to the meat of what's going on. In the very beginning of the story, Nehemiah comes across Jews who have just come back from visiting Israel. Jerusalem, very specifically. And he is overhearing them talk. Again, coincidence? Probably not. And so he jumps right in. He wants to hear the news. He wants to hear how his people are. He wants to hear how his land is, specifically the city of Jerusalem, God's city, where the temple resides, once was. And of course, he hears the message that, well, the people are not doing well. The temple is destroyed. The walls are all ripped down. You can't tell the difference between where Jerusalem starts and stops. It is not a pretty sight. And so Nehemiah takes in all of this news, and I believe providentially. Nehemiah then was, it's very interesting how, do you notice as we get to the end of chapter 1, if I were to ask you what verse in that entire chapter doesn't seem to fit at all? Why on earth is Nehemiah giving us this little bit of information? It would be the very last line in the chapter. Do you see what it says? It's the very last line of the chapter. All this stuff is going on, I'm praying and all this stuff. And oh, by the way, I'm the cupbearer to the king. One of the interesting things about a cupbearer that you may or may not know is that a cupbearer was not just kind of randomly picked. The cupbearer to the king had the complete trust of the king because that was the guy who gave the king his wine, gave the king his drink, which means that the king trusted the cupbearer that there was no poison in that cup, that there was nothing wrong with the food that was being served Nehemiah. So Nehemiah has worked himself up in the ranks. We can infer, we can kind of just build on this, and I don't think it's a light point that Nehemiah being the cupbearer, he has spent years working himself up in the king's court. And what's interesting about this time and place is that if Nehemiah still happened to be the coat check guy, chances are he wouldn't have the king's ear If Nehemiah was the stable boy, if Nehemiah was the dishwasher, he would not have been able to do much about what he heard about the walls of Jerusalem and about the people there. You see, Nehemiah was placed there by God, and he knew this over and over. This was a simple fact. It was a big fact, but it was a simple fact to Nehemiah that the position that he held was given to him by God so that he could use it to accomplish the plan of God. And we see really all over Nehemiah, but if you look just one chapter ahead in Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 12, it says this. Once he finally gets there to Jerusalem, he goes, "Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me, and I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. There was no animal with me, but the one which I rode." What I want to do is build a foundation here. When we talk about being courageous, the thing we must first start with in our own lives, as you kind of look at your life and you assess where your courage is and where your strength comes from, you must first understand that everything providentially in your life is given to you by God. The position that you hold is not random. The position in your family is not random. The kids that you have been given, the husband or wife that you have been given, the aunts and uncles and cousins, your family is not random. The jobs that you hold are not random. The schools, believe it or not, kids, the schools that you go to are not random. God has given you the schools that you attend, the teachers that you have. All of this is providentially figured out by God. Where you are today in every aspect of your life, God is the one that has put you there. Yes, okay, we can talk about all of the work that it took to get the degrees, all the work that it took to rise up in maybe your company, all of those things. And all of those things play into it, but understand that God is the one sovereignly that has given you all of that and put you where you are. And not only that, but you are there, and all of that is orchestrated by God so that he can have a plan for you, very specifically where he put you. Again, he has a plan for you within your family. He has a plan for you within this church body. He has a plan for you, kids, at the school that you are going to right now. And then those of you that hold jobs, God has a plan for you at those jobs. And it might be very complex. It's not going to be just for one simple little thing. It's going to be a very complex thing. But this just sets the groundwork for the other things then that start coming, the building blocks that we see in Nehemiah's life, that he is able to just hear of a problem, see a situation, and react to it with courage. First and foremost, because he gets that God is in control of everything that's going on. And it's important to understand where Nehemiah is in his life right now, in the day that this is being written, because I don't want any of us to go, "Yeah, but you don't understand what my day looks like. You don't understand the position I'm in." Because looking around the room, I know some of us don't have it good right now. I get that. And I don't want to make light of that even a little bit. But what I want you to understand is, again, wherever it is, God is the one that has you in the place that you are in right now today, with everything that comes with it. Second, Nehemiah understood that it was God's provision. Provision, I think, breaks into two things. We're going to look very literally at the word provision, but we have God's provision, his protection, and his power. Nehemiah had it all over his life. Let's look at Nehemiah 2. In the very first verse, it goes like this. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, and can I just, real quick, can I throw in something that I'm not really going to talk about that I think you and I really need to hear? So Nehemiah hears this problem, and you know what he spends the next 6 months doing? Praying. That is a long time. But he spends the time praying on what he should do. He doesn't just jump right in. He asks God what needs to happen. So he prays for a while. In the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence, because for your life you would not be sad in front of the king. And the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, seeing you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart." Then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, "Let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's grave, lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" Then the king said to me, "What are you requesting?" So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it." And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, "How long will you be gone? And when will you return?" So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. And I said to the king, "If it pleases the king, let letters be given to me, to the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates and of the forest of the temple and for the walls of the city and for the house that I shall occupy." And the king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me. One of the things that I think is so vitally important about this passage, and the second building block, is that God has established a plan in your life for you to accomplish. And what's hard to preach on about that plan is I can't tell you what that is. This has to come from God. And again, God has placed you sovereignly so that you have a specific plan in all of the facets of your life. And so if you don't know what that is, that needs to be something that you are praying hard over. But most of us, I think we are established in our jobs and where we are at, and we know those things. And so now we can move on to number two, and it's this, that God will give you the provisions that you need in order for you to be successful at that plan that God has given you. Does that make sense? God has given you all the provisions. How awesome is it that Nehemiah goes before the king to do his job? The king sees, obviously, that he's sad. He can't hide it. And he goes, "Well, how am I supposed to be happy when Jerusalem's a mess? And frankly, I think maybe I'm the guy who can be a part of helping build the walls back and give the people some kind of structure again." And you know what the king really should have said? As the king, "Why would you worry about Jerusalem? Look at the position you have. Look at all the comfort I've given you. Look at everything you have." Instead, the king does something that only God could do. He works through this heathen king and says, "My goodness, what do you need to succeed? It's all yours." And Nehemiah just starts asking. He makes a list. He's aggressive. "Yeah, I need this and this and this and this." And the king says, "Great, it's all yours. Go." So much so that he even provides an army on horseback to go with him. It's pretty amazing. The second thing then we see is protection. God provides for our mission, but then God also provides protection. And we see there is this guy that pops up in chapters 2 through chapter 6. In fact, we're introduced to him in the same chapter, chapter 2, verse 10. If you look there, it says, "But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel." Here's kind of what I think might be happening. Take this or leave it. Just kind of adds color to the story. There are people who are living there already. There are people that have come in from the borders of Israel, from Jerusalem, and have occupied this land now for the past 70 years. And now guys have been coming back, like Nehemiah, to rebuild Jerusalem, to rebuild the temple, to kind of create, in a sense, the nation of Israel once again. And I think a lot of these people are remembering what Israel used to be, the power they used to be, and they say, "No way, this cannot happen again. Israel cannot rise to a status where they can rule over us again." And so what they want to do is they want to keep the people as slaves. They want to keep the walls broken. They want the temple to not be rebuilt. They pretty much want Israel just not to come back. And so these guys really, in a sense, act as bullies. They go and get their cohorts, and they just come after Nehemiah with everything they have. We see over and over again in chapter 2, verse 19, it says, "But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite, servants of Geshem the Arab, heard of it, they jeered at us." So they started with just kind of calling him names and making fun of him. It turns into a whole lot more than this, where they actually engage and really want to try to kill Nehemiah, but God doesn't let them. The rest of the verse says, "What is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" Then I replied to them, "The God of heaven will make us prosper, and we his servants will arise and build, and you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem." Nehemiah is able to say that because he believes that God will protect them. Protect Nehemiah and, of course, the people. And if you turn over to chapter 4, look at verse 9. It's another time when these guys came out and they're trying to cause confusion. You have to remember again, Nehemiah is not an architect. He's not a city planner. I don't even think he was a general contractor by any stretch. He handed wine to a king. But now you have this guy who really is in a position to not know a whole lot of wall building. He's in charge of guys who are not in, who have never built walls before. Not only that, but they really have never fought for themselves before. So they're not warriors either. And so now they have to play this dual role in a position where they're really unlikely heroes. They're guys that they don't know how to build things, and they're not good at protecting themselves. And those are the two things they need to do. And God sees to it that he accomplishes this through them. In verse 9, it says, "And we prayed to our God and set a guard as a protection against them day and night." In Judah, it was said, "The strength of those who bear the burden is failing. There is too much rubble." How many times have you been in your life where you're like, "It's just too hard. It's just too hard. Let's give up. By ourselves, we will not be able to rebuild the wall." And our enemies said, "They will not know or see till we come among them and kill them and stop the work." At that time, the Jews who lived near them came from all directions and said to us 10 times, "You must return to us." So in the lowest parts of the space, behind the walls and open places, I stationed the people by their clans with their swords, their spears, their bows. And I looked and I arose and said to the nobles and the officials and to the rest of the people, "Do not be afraid of them." Why? Because we have an army? No, we don't even know how to fight. Why? Because we know how to build these walls and they'll... No, we... can't even really do that on our own. It says, "Remember the Lord who is great and awesome." And what's the rest of that? "And fights for us." God is the one that protects. He is the one that has created your surroundings, put you in them, has a plan for your life, and then he is the one who will guard you through it. It doesn't matter who comes along. It doesn't matter what the trials or the tribulations that come along. And I'm not trying to downplay those things, because those things are scary. These guys were real. They were coming with spears and swords to kill Nehemiah and his crew. Nehemiah stands up and says, "The Lord is the one who will fight for us." And then, of course, this plays right into preservation. But God doesn't just protect. How amazing is it then that he empowers? So he protects you from the enemy, but then he is the one that actually empowers you. The people's response in all of this was to rise to the occasion. Let's fight. Let's build the walls. It wasn't to sit on the sideline and be like, "Well, let's wait for God to bring somebody else along and do it." It was to get in the game. Ray couldn't swim, and yet he jumps in after this girl. His resume was terrible for that job. The same thing with these people, really the same thing with Nehemiah. And yet Nehemiah, in his courage, in a sense, he understands that it is all from God. And so you and I can act courageously because you and I are provided for. Because we're protected and we're empowered by God. Everything that you need to accomplish your mission, everything that you need to accomplish your mission And again, I'm kind of repeating this stuff, but if that mission happens to be in your very family, if it is just a wrecked marriage that you're not willing to face, if it is kids that are not walking with the Lord, if it's things within your job that have just become unbearable, that it's just amazing that we have to put up with this day in and day out, and every other situation that God has put into your life, He has given you what you need, not to just get through it, but to accomplish it with success, so that you can be used. Too often, I think we're crippled by fear. We think we lack the know-how. We lack education. We lack the skill set. We have the wrong personality. We're not mature enough. We struggle too much with a certain sin. There's too much outside pressure. There's too much opposition. Why on earth would God use me? How could He use me? I will tell you this. God has heard all of the excuses. He heard it from Moses. Do you remember when He went to Moses and Moses said, "No, I'm not your man"? Last week, He went to Jeremiah and Jeremiah said, "I'm sorry, I'm not your man. I can't do anything for you." And over and over and over again, He heard it from David. He heard it from so many people that eventually, when you get to the end of the story, God used them in ways that we wished God would use us to accomplish that much. You and I are lavished with so much grace. We cannot use really any excuse to sit on the sideline. And I'm probably going to repeat this, but you need to hear this too, I think, because I needed to hear this week. The grace that God has poured all over your life is not just for you. The grace that God has poured into your life is mostly for everybody around you, so that you would courageously, in that grace, stand up and proclaim Him. In every one of those circumstances, those hard, hard circumstances. The third thing is that it was God's passion. It wasn't Nehemiah's passion, it was God's passion. This brings in our affections. Nehemiah was passionate about the things of God, about God's name and about God's kingdom. And we find right in the very first chapter, don't we, that when Nehemiah hears about the people and about the walls and about the temple, what does he do? He starts to weep. He doesn't sit back and go, "Oh, thank you, God, for giving me this cushy job. Man, your blessings are unbelievable. Thank you so much for putting me in a position where I don't feel any of this. Thank you for not coming down on me. Thank you that it's those people, that it's them. It's the ones that are way over in Jerusalem. They have some issues. I'll spend time praying for them." But Nehemiah, with compassion, with a passion, wells up because it's from God. And the tears for 6 months come. And he is in earnest prayer over, "What can I do to fix this? God, how are you going to use me to change this situation? What are you going to do?" He has passion. We also see that there was not just a passion for the walls, but there was a passion for the people of God. And we don't have time to read this, but if you, in your studies this week, the best part of Nehemiah, in my instance, because it's the part of the worship service that is just really, really cool, is chapter 8 through probably about chapter 10. Chapter 8 and 9 especially. Read those chapters this week. It's where Nehemiah and Ezra and the leaders lead the people after the walls are built in worship. And it's where the statement says that the joy of the Lord is your strength. Do not mourn. In fact, you know what the people heard? They heard the law being read and they mourned over their sin. And Nehemiah, over and over and over again, thinks confession is a good thing. But you know what he says at that point? He says, "Stop mourning. Stop crying. Look how God is with us. Get off your butt and let's move forward now." Let's move forward. The joy of the Lord can be your strength to accomplish anything. Look what he's done through us. Let's be thankful and worship him and then keep on working. Nehemiah's passion spread to all the rest of the leaders and to all of Israel that was there in Jerusalem. And the people there made a covenant with their God to not break it. They got back on board. They were like, man, Nehemiah, the God that you are passionate about, we want to be passionate about. Nehemiah, the God that you serve, we want to serve him. We want to understand his law so we don't break his covenant the way that we have been doing. We want to follow in your footsteps because Nehemiah was passionate. We tend to follow passionate people, don't we? I don't believe that passion is necessarily a personality trait. There's some of that. But I think passion is something that we just live for. And most of us live for something. A lot of conversations, even in this morning, you can learn very quickly what we're all passionate about because it's the things we talk about. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's a good thing. That's really fun. And those things are gifts from God. And we, if as long as we're thankful to God for those things and he is kind of playing and working with us through those passions, that's a great thing. He's given us those passions. But then there's also all kinds of other passions, again, that we find even in our jobs and in our families and relationally that we have to, those are kind of the things that are harder that we tend to push on the back burner because they're too hard. It's the idea of being passionate about for the lost. Those in our lives that don't know Christ and are maybe just completely apathetic, or maybe even worse, they jeer as much as they can at everything Christian, at Jesus Christ himself. And it's so easy to just push that off at arm's length and to learn to not be passionate about those things. But those are the things, ultimately, that Nehemiah, at least we learn in this book, that he was passionate about. It was for the people of God, and it was for their good. Do you get that? That's why he wanted the walls rebuilt. Because he was passionate for the people of God and their good. We can be courageous when our wants and passions line up with God. It is his will that is to be accomplished on earth as it is in heaven. It is his kingdom that we want to see advanced. Passion for the kingdom of God should make us jump into waters way over our heads. What an awesome song we sang, Oceans. Do you realize that that whole song is us asking God, in a sense, like Peter? We see him walking on waters that if we couldn't walk on, we would drown. We would sink to the bottom and drown. And we are asking God, God, let us come out onto the water. Let us have faith to come out onto the water and do the work with you. Let us be where you are. Because Jesus isn't in where there's safety. He never was. That's not how he walked this earth. And that's not, even as he sits at the right hand of the God, of God the Father, he's in a sense not still wrapped up in safety. What he is doing is he is working through what he has accomplished on the cross. And that is to draw individuals to himself, to build up his church. Do you know how messy it is to work with us? Of course you do. And that's what Jesus chooses to do, to be the head as we are the body, to be the husband as we are the bride, and to work with us with all of our ugliness and our sin, and to transform us and to make us like him. Everything that he is doing and thinking, pretty much his entire existence as he is up with the Father, has everything to do with you. He is mediating for you. All of his priestly duties outside of his sacrifice, because that's accomplished. But now based on that, it's all for us. Do you see the passion there? Do you see how much God is passionate for his people? In fact, Christ's incarnation, I believe, is proof of God's providence, of God's protection, and God's passion for his people. Nehemiah sacrificed comfort, he sacrificed safety, he sacrificed all kinds of blessings to restore and redeem the people of God. Who does that sound like? Nehemiah was a type of Christ. He didn't do it perfectly. I'm sure there were nights where he was scared. The fear was overcome and he couldn't sleep at night. Courage is not the idea of not having fear. It's acting in your fear. Courage is placing your trust in the one who can use you and move you through your fear. As blood-bought children of the Father, how can you and I live more courageously today? What is it? How can we live more courageously this week? It has been my prayer that as I asked this question this morning, that God would already be preparing your hearts all the way back on Tuesday to begin to answer that question. Knowing that you are covered by His providence, His placement, and His plan, you can't fail. There is nothing that you can do to fail. God will see to it that He accomplishes His plan through His people with His power. He's going to use you. That is so exciting. His passion for His unfailing word will see to it that you cannot fail. I ask that you would run to Him and that you would plead with Him if you are struggling to trust in Him. Which one is it? Do you believe that He's not sovereign in your life? That's a hard one to trust in. Do you believe that all of the things that you're dealing with right now today is because of Him? Or do you believe that if you step out in any way that the protection will not be there, that you will crumble, that you will lose your job, that your family will just fall apart, that your relationships will fall apart? Or do you believe that He is truly not passionate for His word? Which one is it? Go to Him, plead with Him, and ask Him for strength in that area. And then I ask, it has been my prayer all week as I've been studying this, because I needed to hear this idea of courage, because I'm not a very courageous person. But my prayer has been, may God increase our faith for His glory and for our courage. So take courage, for the Lord is with you. He will not leave or forsake you. Let's pray.